Hi, everybody. Today is Friday, April 4th, 2025, and our friends, Ambassador Chas Freeman, Professor Morandi, and Colonel Wilkerson are back with us. Welcome back.
Glad to be here.
Let's get started with, I want to focus on the situation between the United States and Iran, but before going to that, it's important to talk about the situation between the United States and Yemen right now. And let me just, there is an article in New York Times. It says that the operation was not successful so far. And the Pentagon official in this article is mentioning that the operation cost the United States $1 billion per month. And here is what the Secretary of State Marco Rubio said about the conflict in Yemen.
The Houthis, everybody wants to get their ships through the Red Sea. We're the only ones doing anything about it, but everyone wants to, you know, get their ships through there. As I said, we've done the world a great favor by taking on this band of criminals who have, unfortunately, sophisticated weaponry that they can use to, I mean, they attack with 150, 160 merchant vessels. 174 times they've attacked the United States Navy. So I think the world should be grateful to the United States for being involved in this and doing this. Everyone thanks us for it. I understand these nations have limited capabilities, despite being very rich countries. Nobody else can project power there and do this. But that said, we think that mission is going to bear fruit, and it's necessary. We can't have a band of criminals controlling that.
Ambassador, do you understand what do they want to do with Yemen?
More of the same, I guess. Stop Yemen from reacting to the genocide in Gaza and the depredations of the Israelis in Syria and Lebanon and the ethnic cleansing in the West Bank. But, you know, Yemen has been bombed for 10 years. The Saudis bombed it with our help. The Israelis have bombed it. We've bombed it. The British have bombed it. And the de facto government there, the Houthi government, doesn't bend its knee. So I think the prospects of success are very, very minimal. I gather the bombing campaign now is focused more on killing particular individuals than against weapon systems. That's probably a war crime, but I don't think there's much chance of success. You should ask Larry though, because he's the military expert.
Larry, go ahead.
I've been involved with this since it began with the United Arab Emirates, the little Sparta. And Mohammed bin Salman, Minister of Defense, I think, portfolio at that time, and trying to find a war he could win really quickly, and found one that he couldn't win at all. But the only reason he was making any progress in that war was because the United States was providing, despite what the Pentagon said, I know they were providing intelligence, fuel. They finally wound up putting out a position that they were providing the intelligence because they wanted the Saudis, who were hitting too many civilians, to not hit civilians. And so they were helping them with the targeting. Well, right after that, they hit a school bus and killed 48 children. Someone went in the debris and found a Raytheon bomb housing in the debris. So we've been helping them all along. And you recall, I think I told you this before, we got under the War Powers Resolution, which gives you special access. You have to put a War Powers Resolution piece of legislation on the floor. You cannot hold it up in committee. Nancy Pelosi tried to, because she was her and Steny Hoyer were playing both sides of the street, as it were. But they finally had to put it on the floor, and it passed in both houses, the House and the Senate. I think that was enough, given that this is a constitutional issue, to where we should have gotten out of that war. We didn't. Trump vetoed it, you recall, and we couldn't override the veto. But I've been involved with it since that time. We have killed, probably, according to Mercy Corps, the UN, various other agencies that have been on the ground in the region, we have killed over 250,000 people. Disease has probably killed another 100,000 or so, cholera, no food, starvation. At one point, the Saudis were actually blockading the port of Hodeidah, so they couldn't get any food in. This has been a brutal struggle that powers that shouldn't be involved in it have been involved in it. And what a farce for Rubio to stand up there and say that we're protecting shipping through the Red Sea. We're the reason the shipping is being stopped. because we're the enabler for Israel doing what it's doing in Gaza and elsewhere. So the Houthis have been very, very explicit about that. And they actually did stop when that stopped for a while during the first phase of the so-called ceasefire, though Israel never honored a single day of the ceasefire. They are doing what they said they would do. And frankly, as far as I'm concerned, as a military professional, I have some respect for them because the rest of the Arab states are freaking cowards.
Professor Morandi, what's your take?
I think the biggest mistake that the United States has made under Trump was to destroy that little bit of soft power that he was able to gain for himself at the beginning of his presidency. I think it's clear that the genocide in Gaza has destroyed US and European, EU, NATO credibility, their image across the world, because they're seen as the force behind the forces behind the genocide. But when Trump imposed a ceasefire, many thought that this ceasefire would hold, or they were at least optimistic that it would be situation would not be as bad as before. And we saw some people, including mutual friends of ours, speaking about Trump being a man of peace. But then when he gave Netanyahu the green light to restart the genocide, and the images from the last 24 hours have been particularly painful to watch. And also alongside that, the bombing of Yemen, I think that's destroyed that little bit of soft power that he had was able to create for himself. And I don't think that can be reversed.
Ambassador, do you understand what the Trump administration has decided to do that, or they're just having some sort of strategy on their part?
I don't think there's any strategy, but I mean, a strategy defines feasible objectives, devotes the necessary resources to achieve them, and has a termination and an end state that it's trying to achieve. I don't see an end state here that it is feasible. I do want to comment, however, Marco Rubio said that countries should or have been thanking us for attacking Yemen and trying to clear out the blockade in the Red Sea that they have pretty successfully implemented for the first time in history, a land-based sea blockade. I'd like to know exactly who has been thanking us other than Israel. I suspect the list does not include anyone, since this is regarded internationally, for the reasons that Professor Morandi mentioned, as American complicity in genocide. It's an extension of our support for Israeli actions that the whole world condemns, which the international legal mechanisms, the International Court of Justice, the International Criminal Court, have ruled against. Which are clearly illegal under international law. So I don't know who's grateful to us for this, except Israel. And Israel can't be very grateful because the Houthi blockade is actually working.
Yeah. It's ruined the port of Eilat.
Yep. It's killed the port of Eilat.
And Lima, let me just add that we did a tabletop at that place that Trump shut down, apparently, the U.S. Institute of Peace, a few years ago. And the sponsors of that tabletop were, in this order, Central Command, African Command, the State Department, the Pentagon, the Joint Staff, and a number of other entities in our national security complex, as well as Europe's. In fact, almost as many counterparts from Europe were there as were there from the United States. And one of the things we pointed out in the tabletop was that unlike the Persian Gulf, where our concern is mainly oil, the Red Sea comprises probably in a given year, 55 to 60% of the world's commerce passing through there of all kinds. Everything from foodstuffs to finished products to you name it. We decided, the group that was there, that this was the new strategic cockpit of competition. That was the phrase that Central Command used. And the focus was going to be there. And that's one reason why we began to just completely overload Djibouti with our troops and such. And so did five or six other nations as well. Turkey, scrambling to get in at the end, couldn't, and is now looking up the coast for a place to put its people because it is so strategic. Well, what's happening right now, all to say that what's happening right now is there are people around the Gulf area, the Persian Gulf area, and northward, including the Russians, who are beavering away at an old supply route, commercial route, trade route, whatever you want to call it. It used to be very dynamic. In fact, we turned it into a very dynamic route during World War II. When we went in before the war actually broke out with the Brits, much to the Iranians' displeasure, but they couldn't do much about it, we went in and started fabricating this line and building out its flanks so they couldn't do anything to us as we moved almost as much up that route as we put into Murmansk. I mean, it's an incredible secret with most Americans. Stalingrad would have never held out if it hadn't been for that route. I think I remember something like 800,000 wheeled vehicles went up that route to the Soviet Union. So they're redeveloping that. And that's going to put the Red Sea, to a certain extent, out of business, because it's much cheaper to do this commerce over land than it is to do it by sea. Look at the history of empire. These trade routes have dictated who's boss and who's not boss for 2,000 years. Well, we're into this again. So we're doing that as well. We are causing the Red Sea to evaporate, the Suez Canal with it, as a trade route in favor of these other routes that are going to be land routes and opened by the burgeoning power of the East, if you will, with the Base Road Initiative, of course, being a huge component of that in Central Asia. So the world's changing before our eyes, and I doubt Marco Rubio even realizes that.
Professor Morandi, how much of what's going on between the United States and Yemen is related to the situation between Iran and the United States?
Well, it's definitely related. But Yemen obviously has agency. They control their own assets. All of the members of the Axis of Resistance have agency. Iran does not give orders to Hamas or Islamic Jihad or Hezbollah or the Popular Mobilization Forces or Ansarullah in Yemen. That's not how it works. They're allies, and Iran supports them by any means necessary, and they supply them, they give them the supplies that they need, but they make their own decisions. But Iran supports their decision, their decision to support the people of Gaza and to put pressure on the Israeli regime to end the genocide. That's something that the Iranians have supported, and they continue to do so. And we saw yesterday the Iranian president speak to a leader in the government in Sana'a in order to show Iran's support. But I think there's also another element to this, and that is that many people are looking to see if Yemen can defend itself against the Americans. And if the Americans were able to easily defeat Ansarullah, then probably that would have created momentum for them to put more pressure on Iran. But from what we're hearing from the New York Times and from what I've been hearing from friends in Yemen, is that the United States has had no success whatsoever with regards to the Ansarullah or the Yemeni armed forces in military installations. They are underground, deep underground. Their forces are spread out. They have been fighting, as was pointed out earlier, this sort of warfare for 10 years. They were much weaker back then. They've been building these underground facilities and factories and sites during these the 7 years of genocidal war imposed by the Saudis and the Emiratis. And under Biden, they continue to build up on those. And Trump doesn't have some secret card up his sleeve that was not in the hands of Biden. There's nothing new that Trump can do that Biden was incapable of doing. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think at one point Biden had two aircraft carriers also in the Red Sea, but he failed. And I think that Trump is going to find out the hard way that he will be unable to defeat Ansarullah. And what he's done is he's, as the colonel rightly pointed out, he's actually helping strengthen the north-south transport corridor between Iran and Russia, because during the ceasefire, and the Ansarullah stopped blocking ships. And then when Netanyahu reimposed the starvation siege, Ansarullah gave a warning and said if they don't end the starvation siege, if they don't stop allowing food to get in, they'll restart the blockade. And when they did that, the Americans restarted their attack. So I think that what Trump has done is that he has harmed shipping in the Red Sea, because the sea wasn't blocked. It was only blocked to ships linked to the Israeli regime. So now all shipping, most probably, it will have to go around the continent. And those ships that want to go through will probably have to pay a lot of money to for insurance. Or some ships may go through without paying insurance, and they'll be taking a risk. But this situation didn't have to happen. All the Americans had to do was to put pressure on the Israelis to end this blockade. Or alternatively, they could have just let the Red Sea left it alone. And the Americans actually, and I think Chaz is right, I don't think anyone's thanking the Americans, because when Ansarullah, or the Houthis as they are often called, when Ansarullah blocked the Red Sea to Israeli shipping, European shipping was still going through. It was only after the Americans started attacking that that this became a much broader issue. So I assume, I haven't looked this up, but I assume that ships that are now going from Asia to Europe are going, for the most part, around the continent, because the Red Sea is no longer safe. So those countries should be complaining to the United States. So our shipping was passing through the Red Sea as it would normally do so. But now we either have to pay a lot for insurance, or we have to go all the way around the continent.
And Nima, let me just add, from a military point of view, this morning I checked with the Pentagon. They won't verify that it's 16 or 17, but I do know that the Houthis have just claimed they shot down one more, and my son operates in this area, and I have a few contacts. I think they have probably shot down at least 15, maybe 16, maybe 17 MQ-9 Reapers. That's $30 million a copy. That's about $500 million that they've taken out of the air with their probably one-tenth the cost of that missiles. So this is not to mention the fact that we're putting ships there that we can precious afford to have there over the time frame that they're there. We don't have enough people to sail the ships that we need to sail to keep the commitments for all the unified commands around the world. And concentrating carrier and carrier strike groups in the Red Sea is a real drain on that. We have not had marine amphibious units and marine amphibious ready groups in their zones of patrol, as it were, for a long time because of people and because of demands like that. And when we concentrate forces like we're doing now to threaten Iran, it's even more of a drain on our people, because our people are too few in the Navy, in the Army. They are too few.
Ambassador.
I just add one thing, and that is the way this blockade works is all dependent on insurance companies. They won't insure ships going through a war zone at any reasonable rate. So what the Ansarullah or the Houthis have shown is that you can leverage Lloyd's of London and other insurance companies to your advantage and shut down commerce. And this is something that it's not unfamiliar during the war to liberate Kuwait, was the same problem. It's clear that we're in a new era in terms of Yemen, which is probably the poorest country on the planet or close to it, mm-hmm. pretty wretched. You know, you can't make it much more wretched than it already is. Therefore, you don't have a lot of leverage. And as Larry said, we've over-concentrated forces there at the expense of other priorities.
Professor Marandi, we had the letter from Iranian government to Donald Trump and to the Trump administration, in which it seems that they're talking about indirect talks with the United States. Why Iran is not interested in direct talks with the United States?
Direct talks with the United States, as we all know, has taken place under different circumstances. But the Iranians have always felt that at the negotiating table, the United States refrained from showing respect and refrained from accepting Iran's sovereign rights. And literally every time that we negotiated with the United States, it ended up as a failure. Whether it was in the 1980s, when Iran was negotiating or speaking with Americans to help them in Lebanon, that was before Hezbollah was created. The Iranians helped to free some American hostages that were being held by different groups. And the Americans under the Reagan administration and President Reagan himself promised a great deal. And what happened was that subsequently the Iranians were further demonized. And the list goes on. Even Iran had negotiations for 2 years with Conoco, the oil company, to give them an oil field in the Persian Gulf. Back then, Mr. Rafsanjani, I think it was when he was the president, he said in an interview that we were giving a green light to the Americans. But what happened was that when the negotiations were about to conclude and they were about to sign an agreement, the Americans slapped on sanctions against Iran's oil and gas industry. And the list goes on. Every time we had these negotiations, and the most famous, of course, was the Axis of Evil, which came right after the invasion of Afghanistan, and probably even more, of course, more famous is the JCPOA. So the Iranians are very cautious about having any negotiations with the United States. And under these circumstances, when Trump is threatening Iran to change that policy, would be a sign of weakness, or at least it would be interpreted to be a sign of weakness. So I think it was obvious that the Iranians, and the leader in particular, would not accept direct negotiations. But of course, as has been the case, Iran continues to be open to indirect negotiations and messages being sent back and forth. That's never stopped. There are different means for messages to be sent back and forth, and we've had indirect negotiations as well. So I think that it's clear that if the Iranians did choose to accept direct negotiations, that would have been widely interpreted as a weakness, and then the Americans would have been far more demanding at the negotiating table.
Ambassador.
I think in the current circumstances, the United States has made demands on Iran that Iran absolutely cannot accept, and that those include destroying its missiles, basically disarming itself, ending its peaceful nuclear program, as well as the putative nuclear weapons program. Basically, the Israeli objective with regard to Iran, which the Trump administration seems to have adopted as its own, is to reduce Iran to the status of Syria, which has no defenses, and which has only limited sovereignty, if that. And I think I'm not an expert on your country at all, but I have a firm feeling that the supreme national interest in Iran, as in many other countries, is the preservation of national identity, dignity, and self-respect. And basically, the United States appears to be making demands which are contrary to all of those values that I assume motivate the Iranian government.
Larry.
Well, I just read a piece by Stephen Kinzer, with whom I'll appear later today on a radio show in New York City. And that piece strikes all the notes that Chaz just stroke, just touched on, and all the notes that Professor Mirandi just touched on and more. You can't imagine a man who thinks about deals the way Donald Trump does and is utterly ignorant, and I can say that I think with full confidence that I'm right, of Iranian history, of Persian history, is going to do a deal with the Iranians under these circumstances. Maybe it'll happen. Maybe they will suck up and, you know, somehow bend over and take it in order to get the sanctions relieved or whatever. That's a possibility, of course. But this is like oil and water. You know, I don't know how Trump, and it's getting that way with Putin too. It's getting that way with Putin over Ukraine. So, you know, you set yourself up in this art of the deal posture, and that's all you know. And you have no empathy for the other side, none whatsoever. You do not know the other side's history or their region's history. You know, you're utterly ignorant of that. And then you're going to go into negotiations. Sorry.
There is a serious issue here, structural issue in the Trump administration. I believe Mr. Trump may actually want to have a deal.
Yes.
To do a deal with Iran or to do a deal with Russia. But his entourage, his subordinates, in the case of Iran, want regime change. They don't want to do a deal. And they've taken his negotiating style, which is to open with bombs and bombast and bragging and other hostile acts. He did that with North Korea, as I recall, before he then relented. This is the way he starts a negotiation. For those who are opposed to a deal, this offers a perfect opening to contrive to prevent a deal. And in many ways, I think Doug McGregor said it correctly. He said he used the analogy of the Austro-Hungarian Empire's ultimatum to Serbia after the Sarajevo assassination of the Grand Duke in 1914. 10 non-negotiable demands. The Serbs accepted 9 of the 10, and Austria-Hungarian Empire declared war on Serbia, starting World War I. In other words, the whole point of the ultimatum was to start a war, not to start a negotiation. And I think that is the way Mike Waltz and others are framing this. So, and I could see many elements of the same sort of dynamic at work in the discussions with Russia over Ukraine, where Mr. Trump, I think, wants a broad rapprochement in cooperation with Russia for a variety of reasons, but many of those around him and the Europeans don't. Yeah. Yep.
Professor Mann, do you want something to add? Do you have?
I think Larry and Chaz said what they said was absolutely correct. All I can do is just add a couple of small footnotes. One is that we already have a history with Trump, and that is the JCPOA itself. And it was signed by the U.S. government, or it was accepted by the U.S. government. Many Iranians never thought it was a good deal. I was not one of the opponents of the administration, but I too had criticisms of the deal. But the Iranians, once they agreed to the deal, they implemented it. There was a consensus in Iran among the different parts of the state that we have accepted this, so we have to implement it in full. Obama, of course, violated the deal. He did so from day one. But then when Trump tore up the deal, that basically led to a situation in Iran where they felt that, or at least the bulk of the political establishment felt that we cannot negotiate with the United States in future because they can do the same. There's no trust. There has to be, in order for negotiations to take place, there has to be some trust, because you have to be able to believe that the other side is going to implement whatever it agrees to do. But with, in the case of Trump, we, even with Canada and Mexico, over the last few weeks, we've seen him constantly shift his position. And even if there is, let's say, hypothetically speaking, some sort of an agreement with Iran, who's to say that he won't wake up the next day and say that Iran did something somewhere, or a so-called proxy did something somewhere, and so we're not going to abide by the deal anymore. It's just not possible to deal with him, at least under the current circumstances. And the second point that I would like to add is that the United States has more than enough trouble as it is right now. And I think the Iranians see the situation in Ukraine. They see the situation with China. They see, of course, the situation with the stock market. They see the divisions inside the United States, the divisions with Europe. And they know that the United States is not in a position to undermine Iran's, at least with conventional weapons, to undermine Iran and to win, to defeat Iran. That's just not possible. So there are two components here. One is that the Iranians have been preparing themselves for a potential war, literally since the invasion of Iraq, I would say, with all these underground drone and missile bases, as well as other capabilities. And on the other hand, the Iranians recognize that the United States is on the relative decline. Iran has acquired new friends and allies. It's not nearly as isolated as it was before. As we speak, Iran is selling its oil, whereas maximum pressure was far more effective under the previous Trump administration. The situation has changed. And then there's, of course, the religious and the cultural component, especially, you know, in Iranian culture, Shia culture, with regards to resistance. And that is something that I think contributes to what the resistance in Yemen, it contributes to the resistance in Lebanon, and obviously it contributes to the culture of resistance in Iran, something that I think Alistair Crook, once upon a time, in a book that he wrote, I think he alluded to this. It was a long time ago, so I'm not quite sure, but I think he alluded to that in his book. So I think that the Iranians feel that the United States cannot succeed. Not that the Iranians want war. Iran wants to, they want peace. They want to make sure that this does not end in bloodshed. We have enough misery in this region as things stand. But I think that the Iranians are much more confident about their position today compared to 5-6 years ago. That the world is very different today than it was when Trump was first president.
Ambassador, do you think that the United States under the Trump administration and the way they're trying to play with the case of Iran, you see they're leaning toward having some sort of talks, even indirect talks, or you see much more military operations and all of that, and as they're doing in with Yemen?
At the moment, the emphasis is on military pressure. I think it's a very dangerous moment. I want to make a point just to follow up Professor Mirandi's point about the perceived unreliability of Mr. Trump and the United States, because it's more than Mr. Trump, actually. There's quite a record of Americans forgetting agreements that we've solemnly concluded or just abandoning them. There's a basic principle in negotiation, which is that to negotiate a transaction is also to negotiate a relationship. And if you don't negotiate the transaction in a way that leaves the possibility of future negotiations open and adds to your credibility rather than subtracts to it, you're not going to get a negotiation. And I guess this principle does not apply in New York real estate transactions, but it applies everywhere else. And the final point is, given the tariff tantrum that Mr. Trump has just thrown on the world, Iran's actually very fortunate. You don't have much trade with us, so you can't be sanctioned, can't be tariffed.
Larry, your take on the Trump administration, are we getting to the point that the Trump administration goes with a war with Iran, on Iran, waging a war, or they're trying to do everything to avoid that? How do you feel about that?
I can't imagine that the Pentagon is sanguine about such a prospect. I know they haven't been for a long time. And part of it is what Professor Mirandi and Ambassador Freeman were pointing out. A lot has changed with Iran's capabilities. A lot has changed. And the whole time we were talking about Al-Ansar and the Houthis, and I was thinking about why in the world would we, who under Jimmy Carter and Zyg Brzezinski started this campaign to arm the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, wouldn't think the Russians were doing the same thing with Al-Ansar in Yemen? I'm quite confident they are. I'm not so sure about China, but if I were China, I might be playing in that game too a little bit. Maybe not as directly as probably the Russians would be. So we aren't up against just that. We're up against this huge shift of power that's taking place and that more and more people are jumping on the bandwagon of. BRICS is just a visible manifestation of that. That's a dangerous place to be, especially when we're abandoning our 700 million European allies, however they might be colored at the moment. And if you watch Hegseth on the lawn of the White House talking about the delicious capabilities of Donald Trump, one of them being strategic instability, indetermination, strategic whatever you get, that's not what you want, not at this point in time. As Professor Mirandi was saying, especially if you're going to go into some kind of negotiation and you have some positive expectations about it, you don't want to be strategically unpredictable, because what he was saying is perfectly right. You know, Iran had a deal with us that had the force of international law. They don't give a hang about the United States Congress. They don't give a hang about the fact that we didn't ratify it in the Senate and make it a formal treaty. They knew it was an agreement with the UN Security Council, Perm 5. Germany, Europe as a whole, and we broke it. And the guy who broke it is the president seeking to negotiate with him now, with bombs leading the way. It's nonsense. It's absolute nonsense in my view. And I think we're headed in both Ukraine for a little bit different reason, but a lot of the same major reason, and in the Levant for disaster, if it can get any better than the disaster we're already enabling with the deaths yesterday and the day before, punctuating that dramatically. 59%, I think, now of the American people of whatever persuasion don't like Israel. 59%, that's a shift of monumental proportions. And it's just going to get worse. It's just going to get worse. You can't keep hiding this under your Tom Cotton, Joe McCarthy rhetoric. You cannot keep hiding it from the American people that we're the enablers of this atrocity that's happening in the Levant. And it's all the warp and woof now of Donald Trump. He owns it. He owns it. He owns all this perfidy, all this perniciousness, all this duplicity, all this braggadocio, all this bombast, and all this bombing.
Professor Morandi, the other part of the conflict is what's going on in Lebanon. The new government is in Lebanon and they're trying to get along. Hezbollah is trying to get along with the government. On the other hand, you see incapability of the government in order to communicate with the West and convince them to put pressure on Netanyahu. How do you find the situation there?
Well, I think that actually the Americans are making a big mistake here as well, because they've been able to, with the help of the Saudis and other countries in the Persian Gulf, install a president and a prime minister and leaders in the armed forces that are pro-Western. But we see that the United States continues to allow the Israelis to murder people in Lebanon and to bomb Lebanon. Just today, or just hours ago, the Israelis murdered three Palestinians in a strike on a home. A father who was a member of Hamas, and two of his relatives. I think a daughter and a son-in-law. I'm not quite sure, but three people were murdered. I think it was in the south, in Sidon. But so the Americans are the guarantor, but they're allowing the Israelis to constantly murder Lebanese citizens. The government is pro-American, but they are seen as incapable of defending the country. The armed forces are pro-American, but they're incapable of protecting the borders or stopping the Israelis from attacking. And that is only showing Lebanese society and people outside of Lebanon that Hezbollah is right. Hezbollah does need to remain armed because the state is not going to protect its citizens. So every time a new airstrike is carried out, every time a new Lebanese citizen is killed or a Palestinian is murdered, the Americans are helping Hezbollah to make its case that we need our arms. And I think this is very important because public perceptions across the region are changing very swiftly. Let me give you another example. Syria. When the dirty war in Syria began, when the protests turned into a dirty war, and then you had the United States get involved, and then Operation Timber Sycamore and all that began, the regional media that's controlled by states, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the Emirates, and others, they tried to turn what was going on in Syria into a sectarian war. And they tried to blame Iran, Hezbollah, for protecting an Alawite government. Hezbollah and Iran never saw the situation like that. They were protecting the region against a dirty war, Syria against a dirty war, where the Americans and its allies, its regional allies, were using ISIS and Al-Qaeda. But because of the soft power that the West and its regional allies had, they were able to turn a lot of people against Hezbollah, Iran, and the resistance. Now, things have changed completely. Mm-hmm. I recall back then when I was trying to explain Iran's position in Syria, a lot of people who all of us know, and I don't want to name them because their positions have shifted completely, they were against Iran, they were attacking Hezbollah, they were attacking the resistance, saying, yes, this is a sectarian war. Whereas Hezbollah, Iran didn't see that they didn't see it that way. Now, the public mood has shifted. People have seen what's going on in Syria, many, for what it is. And Iran today, I think, is something, I find this extraordinary. Iran today is very popular, whereas Iran has always been unpopular. for four decades, if the Americans had no success against Iran, they did succeed in demonizing Iran. And it was demonized across the world. I'm not saying Iran didn't have supporters anywhere, but wherever I went and wherever I went to conferences, there were always questions and there were always antagonism, and the Iranian position was not understood. Now we have a situation where people across the world are attacking me, saying, why don't you carry out a true promise three, as if I have some sort of authority in Iran. Or they say, why don't you make a nuclear weapon? You know, I just, you know, I'm sitting at home. I'm just a teacher at university. But the point is that the mood has shifted. People are looking to Iran and they're looking to the resistance because they see that no one else is going to do anything. And in Syria now, we see that many people who in the past, many people who we all know, who had a completely different position, they had a completely different position from what they have now. They see Syria for what it is. They see Jolani for who he is, and they see the role that was played by Turkey and NATO and Israel. And all of this, I think, may not seem very important to some, but I think that this is catastrophic for the United States and the West and its allies, because they've been able to keep the region divided. They've been able to keep people hostile towards Iran for a very long period of time. But that is now melting away. So their behavior in Lebanon, even though people are being killed, it is not to their benefit. And the same is true, by the way, with Yemen. The more they bomb Yemen, the more they make Ansarullah popular. The more they make the axis of resistance more popular. The more Trump threatens Iran, the more people look at Iran more favorably. So none of this is going well for the West. Of course, this all is, you know, this people die as a result. It is catastrophic, the scenes that we see. Seeing public services and public installations being destroyed in Yemen, kids being killed there, in Gaza, in Lebanon, in Syria, across the board, the threats made against Iran. None of this is a good thing. But I think that the Americans, who've always, their strong point has always been soft power in the past. I think that was always the most important tool in their toolbox. That is gone. And now Iran, surprisingly, and the axis of resistance has quite a bit of soft power. I'm not saying that they're universally admired or that they're loved across the region or across the world. No, but the perceptions have shifted. And I think that has a great deal of significance.
You're muted, Nima.
Yeah, Ambassador, go ahead.
No, I was just pointing out you're muted. I'm sorry to say that I agree with Professor Mirandi. Iran and others, the victims of American aggression and maximum pressure, have the sympathy of the world. I'm not sure it's support, but sympathy, certainly. And that is a very different situation. That undoes the demonization, which was so successfully imposed on Iran and other countries in earlier days. But this is all a part of a broader American retreat from moral leadership globally. We really have lost the high ground everywhere. And we're not even the leaders in Europe anymore. Our NATO is now split between the United States and most European members of NATO who disagree with the United States. Some, like Denmark, who feel actually threatened by the United States or Canada, for that matter. So the world has indeed changed. I think myself that one of the changes that is occurring is that rather than being dominated anymore by great power rivalry, the international order is evolving to give middle-ranking powers, including Iran, including Turkey, including some European powers that were eclipsed, more freedom of maneuver. and things are fluid, and you cannot take the old pattern for granted. And I agree that it doesn't appear that the new administration has woken up, or at least Marco Rubio and company have woken up to the changes that are occurring, which require a response by the United States and others of diplomatic agility, rather than frozen attitudes or imagining that we can conduct the kind of diplomatic trench warfare we did in the Cold War.
Cole, here is a clip from Netanyahu talking about Iran and the threat coming from Iran to Europe. Here is, what's your take on that, Cole?
The Iranian axis, the Iranian terror axis, which threatens not only us, but Europe and many of our neighbors in the Middle East. We're committed to doing so. And by doing that, we're also protecting Europe.
What does Iran have to do with Europe, Cole?
Well, the axis that is being threatened here is the Israeli-American axis. And I agree with what was just said about that. From state-sponsored torture in my administration in 2002 to now state-sponsored and world-vivified genocide, murder, and slaughter, the United States is going down, down, down in the estimation of the rest of the world. And it's remarkable how little recognition of that there is in this country, especially amongst those people who are still, and they are dwindling now to a certain extent, even in his own party, supporters of Trump. And, you know, what was our, whether we lived up to it or not, as Professor Morandi said, our soft power, our diplomacy, our international relations, our relations with other people in the world was part of our strength, enormous strength from 1945 on. It's gone. It's gone. We're being every day reviled and no longer looked as, you know, the world order keeper, so to speak, not the global policeman, but at least the supporter of that mechanism we set up after World War II, including the UN. We're seen as the revilers of it. We're seen as the destroyers of it. We're seen as the most likely country in the world, and this scares me to death every time I think about it, to resort to nuclear weapons when it all comes down to a realization that we have lost. We've lost, and it's contested somewhere by one of these other antagonists who doesn't want to be an antagonist, but we force them into it. That's my great fear right now, that we will get into a conflict like that at this period in time where we're checking our six and trying to figure out what's happening to us when what's happening to us is self-inflicted, 99% self-inflicted. And we'll get in a conventional contest. We'll lose. Iran could be such a contest. And we'll resort to the ultimate weapons to stop that loss. That's a troubling prospect. And yet it's one that I think about every day, and I didn't before this time period.
Yeah. Just to wrap up this session, the question, Ambassador, would be what can we do, or what the Trump administration can do in order to somehow deal with the situation in the Middle East? The first step would be with Israel or with Iran?
Well, I think in order to recover some measure of international credibility, we're going to have to give Israel some tough love, which we have not done. We do not have an America First policy in the Middle East. I'd be happy to see one. We have an Israel First policy. That is a mistake. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that perhaps Mr. Trump should talk to more conspiracy theorists who badmouth people that he's put on his staff. So he fires those people. because he is surrounded by people who are in the pocket of Israel, who are anti-Russian, who are anti-Chinese, and who have no constructive ideas about how to deal with any of these countries. For 30 years I practiced diplomacy. The purpose of diplomacy is to listen to the other side and decide what you can say to persuade the other side to take your point of view and do things that you want them to do. You don't get there by sanctioning, tariffing, bombing, threatening such people. And in the case of Ukraine, I'm afraid the negotiations have gone off the track because they don't address the basic concerns with which the Russians began their misadventure in Ukraine. They are peripheral. Mr. Trump wants to write off the Ukraine war. There's more to the Ukraine war than just about Ukraine. In fact, it was never really about Ukraine. So we're going to have to address the question of Ukrainian neutrality, European security architecture with a neutral Ukraine, whatever's left of it in that, and the rights of minorities in various European countries, especially Ukraine. We're going to have to address these issues. Just calling for a ceasefire doesn't do it. So there's a real question in my mind about whether the people Mr. Trump has hired are on his wavelength, whether they're loyal to him in any sense other than sycophantic, and whether they are competent. And the jury is out on all of these things.
Those are very powerful questions.
Yes.
Go ahead, Professor Mahendi.
Yeah, I agree. And I recall since Chaz was speaking about conspiracy theorists, hopefully they could speak to Trump and force him to kick people out of his team. There's another story that's linked to Trump and Iran that I think that shows the problem you can even look at it from a different perspective, and there's still a problem. And that is that after Trump met the Koreans, after he met the North Korean leader, the North Korean foreign minister met, I think, Dr. Zarif, the former Iranian foreign minister. I don't recall whether it was in Iran or somewhere else, but I think it was in Iran. And they asked the foreign minister, what was Trump like? And he said it was fine, everything was okay, and the conversation was all positive until Trump left the room. And then Pompeo and Bolton, they took over, and it was business as usual. Everything fell apart immediately. So the problem is not just about Trump himself being unreliable. It's the people around him. So yeah. Even when Trump does something that I would consider to be positive, meaning speaking with the North Koreans, he's incapable of managing the negotiations, even though, again, as was said, I think, by Chaz earlier, I don't know how business is conducted on Manhattan Island or in New York, but that's not how negotiations are conducted. You cannot just go in, have a photo op, have some pleasant words to say, and then leave the room, and then have the same nasty and negative figures take over and push the whole thing back to the dead end that it was in the first place.
Yeah. Yep. Colonel, your take to wrap up.
I agree with those remarks completely, especially as it pertains to Kim Jong-un and the opening, as it were. And I think that's inevitable with almost anything Trump undertakes, even with what appears to be, and I'll say this in a positive sense rather than negative, a sycophantic group. That is to say, if he set the goalpost, they're going to march toward that goalpost. But their incompetence in marching towards that goalpost is just as much a deal breaker as the other people's insidious undermining it. So I don't see where we are in terms of being in a positive place.
Thank you so much, Ambassador Chaz Freeman, Professor Mahendi, Colonel Wilkerson. Great pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you.
Thank you. It was a great pleasure.
Yeah. Thank you.